Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
I don't know why the leaders of this sport just crap all over the sport so much. It's just amazing. They're constantly telling you that everything's horrible.
SI's Ross Dellinger.
Now, I'll say this. We're at 41 bowls right now, I believe. We won't be expanding. You know, I don't think we'll be having new bowls come up.
And SI's Pat 40.
No, man, you did your job. You asked the questions that need to be asked. You asked it professionally. It's a Mike Gundy problem. It's not a you problem. And there's so many people that want to apologize to college football coaches for having to ask that question or questions like it. Don't apologize for doing your job. Just do it.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod. And I got to say, transfer portal's completely out of control. I just the other night saw Cincinnati's coach at Wisconsin. Bigger schools are just crap. I mean, actually, give credit to Luke Fickell for actually coaching that game.
Sure,
got the W. Most of them run from that because they don't want to start with the zero with the loss.
But yeah,
didn't see a lot of outrage about that. Did you?
No, I failed to see that.
Where was Narduzzi? Where was Narduzzi in the world is ending?
Yeah, we needed a good guardrails lament for that.
Guardrails, coaches are going to bigger schools for more money.
Newsflash, players are too, Dan.
Yeah, well, not $5 million for Drake May, though, as we predicted. No, that was not even...
Shockingly. Although I did think it was funny that, like, Mac Brown helped fan that flame himself, and then Drake May had to put it out.
Yeah, but it was a good story for Mac. That's the thing. I will say this, that the fear-mongering coaches that are screaming are doing enormous credibility damage amongst some segment of fans.
Yeah.
Like, there's absolutely people out there who are like, this sport's dead. It's over. This sucks. And I don't think they're going to stop watching, but they are absolutely killing the credibility of their sport.
Yeah, they're not helping.
So, I mean, it's their wherewithal to shoot the... to attack the hand that feeds them, but not really sure that we're really in a panic. But it is bowl season, and before we get to the two semifinal games that we still have to go through, Ross, you did have some news about the bowl industry actually thinking of changing its ways. Please recap for us.
Yeah. I had a conversation with Nick Caparelli, the bowl season executive director, and he started detailing a conversation that he plans to have this offseason with FBS commissioners about the future of bowls and how bowls and the bowl structure can evolve with the rest of college sports. You know, we let off the show talking about transfer portal and the NIL situation, and that's an evolution that I think college football is making. I think the bowls want to evolve with it. And, you know, one of the big things, there's several topics that they'll discuss with commissioners in the offseason, but I think two or three bigger ones I'll hit on. And one of them is NIL. And Nick Caparelli actually came out with what I would say is a fairly strong quote saying that, you know, if conference commissioners want, bowls can steer the money that the bowl payouts, millions in bowl payouts that usually go to conferences and then are distributed to schools. Instead of giving it to conferences, they can give it to the players playing in the game in maybe an equal distribution, you know? So the average bowl game payout is, I don't know, like $2 to $4 million. Some of them are $8 million. Some of them are, you know, $500,000. But I guess it's around $2 to $3 million is probably the average, maybe. For Power Five, might be more like $4 or $5 million. If you did the math, 150 players on each team, 300 players in total, and you divided $3 or $4 million, you know, you're talking about to play in the bowl game, getting a check of about $10,000 to $15,000 a player. If you were to cut the checks and do the math, so interesting. So that's one of the topics.
Would the players get all of it?
You know, he made it sound like players will get all of it. I'll read a couple of his quotes here. When I asked him about this, about NIL what can Bowles do when it comes to NIL? Because right now, bowl sponsors are getting creative on some NIL situations with players. I don't think they're giving NIL to all the players, but it's just here and there. They're doing some experimenting. Then I kind of ask Nick, how can it get a little deeper, like how Bowles can be more involved? And he said, I'll read this quote, "We are really eager to have that conversation. We think we can be a great solution for the commissioners when it comes to NIL. We know they are under increased pressure to find ways to put money in the pockets of student athletes, especially with the rapidly escalating television revenue. They're not able to pay players directly. If they were to desire Bowles to make payments directly to players instead of conferences and schools, we can do that. The payouts from bowl games could certainly be directed entirely to the players instead of the conferences if commissioners wanted." So it's an interesting, certainly an interesting situation. I'm sure will be talked about in the spring. And one of the other real quick topics of discussion will be bowl eligibility standards, which was changed in 2010 to allow 6-6 teams, and which changed in 2012 to actually allow 5-7 teams if there are not enough 6-6 teams. So the eligibility standard, there's talk of maybe raising back the eligibility standard of a bowl where a team has to be 7-5. And maybe you use the 6-6 teams for emergency kind of cases, like you would currently use 5-7 teams. So that's certainly a topic of discussion too this offseason.
So I guess my thing is this would be just a way. So right now what a conference does, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is what they do, is all the teams in the league. So let's say it's the Big Ten. All the teams in the league that get bowl money goes into the conference coffers, and then they split that money out, and they divide that up by the number of teams, so everyone kind of gets an equal payment, even if you're not in a bowl. And the bowl, like having Ohio State and Michigan both in the playoff, which are bowl games, but that payout is so enormous that it can cover the, and I can't even think of what bowl, but whatever, Wisconsin maybe loses money playing in its bowl or something like that, or a 6-6 team loses money because they have to travel. You have to stay down there for 3 days to 5 days or more. You have to buy tickets to the game that you'll never sell. The bowl games are basically welfare cases, and they have all sorts of underwritten revenue that you would normally never get. And so they kind of cover it by pooling it all together, so you don't actually lose any. The main school doesn't lose and technically lose the money, or the participating school. So what this would do is basically the conference would be on the hook for all of that money. It's a way for a conference to funnel whatever that bowl payout to players by not paying them directly. Does that make sense? Is that how I'm kind of hearing that?
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like, right?
So they're going to take the Big Ten's going to take their TV money or their, and say, well, we'll cover our postseason money and pay our players. And every conference could do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Now, the one thing, I don't know whether it's clear in that or not, is if this becomes, yes, is it a blanket conference payout like it is now? Or, you know, do Michigan State and Rutgers get NIL bowl payouts for their players if they don't make a bowl, or is it just the bowl teams?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that part of this is an incentive for players to play in a bowl game, you know, not to opt out, obviously. Right. And if you don't participate in the bowl game, you probably don't get that check, right? So those teams that don't make a bowl, I would assume would not get this NIL payment. I think that, yeah, one of the big things here, well, two things, and Nick Caporelli said it in that quote, is that, you know, right now we're in just such a weird situation with NIL that, you know, schools and conferences can't really pay the players directly. So what's happening is, as we've talked about in the show quite a bit, is boosters are pooling money and they're funneling it through a third party that is paying the players. So the bowls, at least the way Caporelli puts it, would actually be able to be kind of a solution for schools and conferences to give NIL, right? And instead of distributing the bowl payouts to their schools, who then invest it into their athletic departments in whatever way, some of that going to students, but not in cash. This is a way to actually give them cash. Right. And it's also a way to incentivize making a bowl for players, and also a way to incentivize playing in a bowl. In a lot of ways, it makes a lot of sense.
Would this be enough to get the, like, it seems like a lot of the guys skipping are looking at, hey, man, I got to prep for the NFL. And if I move up 14 spots in the draft, I make the 10 grand or 15 grand. Mm. Like, is this enough? Is really would be my question, particularly for those big name players. I don't know, but it's certainly an interesting way to do it. My thing with the bowls is they do pretty well in the ratings. I mean, even the bad bowls.
Incredibly well. It's crazy. Yeah,
I think that. Remember, we mocked the Bahama Bowl, which was like a Friday afternoon between 2 6-6 teams, and it still did almost 1 million viewers, like 800,000 or 900,000 viewers. Is that right? I think I saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, not bad for a Friday afternoon. Really good for a Friday afternoon.
That's, yeah. It most places would kill to have that kind of rating on a Friday afternoon broadcast of any kind.
A college basketball game, like a good college basketball game, doesn't get that on Tuesday night.
Well, and I had some of the data, Dana, just really quickly, like some of this data in 2021. Now, this includes CFP playoff. You know, it does include playoff bowls, but bowls average are right around 5 million viewers a bowl game. Now, if you take out CFP, it might be more like 3.5 or something like that, but a bowl is still averaging over 2-3 million in viewership. And that, you know, that number, that $3.5-4 million number would have exceed the 2021 average viewership for a Major League Baseball playoff game. It's wild. Right. In this year's Vegas Bowl, pulled in 2.5 million viewers. By the way, a blowout, right? Florida got blown out by Oregon State. Still a 2.5 million average viewership for that game. Beat UCLA Kentucky basketball, which was on CBS, 2 million viewers. Beat Celtics Lakers, which was aired on ESPN. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah.
Well, and I think as a legalized sports wagering still, it's in a lot of places right now, but there's still some big states to come, including California, where like one out of every 8 Americans live in California, right? So there's more to come on that as that continues to get more popular, as to generationally. That's my thing all along, is bowl games are fine as long as participating schools are willing to lose money in the actuality to go. As long as they're willing to prop them up, these bowls will never go out of business, and they'll get, you know, it's not a bad business. It's why a lot of these guys make a lot of money running the bowl. And it's why ESPN will just create as many bowl games as it possibly can. Like, it just runs out of teams. It doesn't run out of bowl games. They just create another Frisco Bowl, another Cheez-It Bowl, if they could get every team in the league, in the country, to play in a bowl, they'd do it.
Yeah.
There'd be, 131 teams, so that one team would be left out. And they would...
That's UMass.
Sorry, UMass. Yeah. They would do that. That's why people are like, move the bowls to the beginning of the season. No, this is a great business.
Yeah.
And it's working, and people make fun of it, or they get mad about it and all this stuff. It's like, who the hell... who cares?
Well, that's the thing.
I mean, game's on, watch it. If it's not on, don't watch it. I don't care who's playing either, though. I don't really tune in because I'm like, oh, I'm really excited to see... I don't know, this 8-4 Missouri starters. I don't really care.
I don't know. I'd much rather see the best players play.
Well, yes, but I don't know that they have to do this. I guess that's how many more people watch because someone's starters are playing? I would love it, the old system, everyone played. It'd be great, but I get it. I get why you don't.
Yeah, I get it too. But that's one of the reasons I like this idea for incentivized playing with financial benefit. And take some of that bowl money let's give it to the actual players and get all the best players to play, or try to at least. There's some that I'm sure it's not going to be enough of a difference maker monetarily for them to want to say, I don't want the risk. I want to prepare for the NFL. But if you're getting more of the guys, at least, that people have heard of and want to see play in the games, the games will be better. They may not be more watched, to your point, that people are just going to watch because it's football and it's the holiday season and, you know, you're going to a party or you want to bet on it or whatever. But the better the game, the better the sport, the better the bowl games are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a and it's a weird concept, these bowls, because if you just look at the business, like, you know, you take a college football team, creates a product, their team. They market the product. They invest everything in the product. They bring the customers for the product. And at the end of the year, they hand it off to someone else and say, here, you sell our, here's our product. You make money off it. And so, and these guys sit there and go, this is great. I got two, look at these two fan bases I got. Well, who created the fan base? It wasn't the Liberty Bowl. It wasn't the Bad Boy Moore's Bowl. They're watching the team or they're watching this sport. And yet you get, you outsource it, give these guys a thing. I mean, hey, if they're, the other thing is the playoff money makes, I always said the bowls won't go out because of the playoffs. They're, it actually creates a bigger pool of postseason revenue that can be redistributed. Cause these, like, right, there's, what is it? $500 million more per year right now. If they, right. That's why they're starting early.
Yeah, right. $450 million additional dollars the two extra
right.
years.
Right, and in 3 years, it's going to be a billion more or something like that. So probably, we got plenty of money to pay guys to play in these other bowls. The bowl industry isn't in trouble. It's in great shape. When we were ripping the bowl industry 15 years ago, people, oh, it's out of business. I had Jim Delaney claiming the bowls will all die. I said, I'll buy every bowl. Anyone wants to sell me a bowl game, I will buy it right now. Nobody took me up on the offer.
Well, that's nobody. That's one of the interesting things is the, and I'm seeing responses on social media to this story of mine this morning. And a lot of it is, oh, you know, too many 6-6, 5-7 teams playing bowls. We have too many bowls. It's watered down, all this stuff. And it's like that is a narrative that you've heard for a while. But the thing is, the TV ratings for even the worst bowls continue to be really good. And so if you want bowls to go away, I guess stop watching them on TV, because, and Carparelli said this, like the bowl industry is market driven, right? I mean, it's market driven. And so, what are you going to do? The market, because of TV viewership, the market wants more bowls. No community or city or venue or sponsors being forced to put on a bowl. They want to put on bowls because the viewership's high, and so sponsor dollars come in pretty well, and it does well for a community and all this stuff. Now, I'll say this. We're at 41 bowls right now, I believe. We won't be expanding. You know, I don't think we'll be having new bowls come up. I don't think that's something that's going to happen. But, you know, bowls dropping off.
If they lowered it down to 4 wins, they'd make them.
But they're going the other way. They're going the other way. 7-5.
Right. If you go up to 7-5,
that surprised me.
Yeah, you're going to eliminate, if they end up doing that, and I'll believe it when I see it. Yeah. If they end up doing that, then yeah, you're going to eliminate 4-7 bowls a year, probably.
I don't see the use.
And that's hard to see. It is. It's hard to see happening.
I mean, what would we do without Georgia Southern Buffalo?
My life would be empty.
Yeah, and ESPN doesn't want it to go away. That is space. That's filling time. It's filling 4 hours in a kind of a somewhat dead period. And you know, we're Pat and I are both here in Atlanta. I just ran into Gary Stokin, the CEO of the Peach Bowl, and he was talking about how the 2.5 weeks bowl season, that those 2.5 weeks are ESPN's most profitable 2.5 highest rated viewership of the year, that 2.5 week stretch. So ESPN wants it. And that's something that Caparelli said that I put in that story. The CFP will go out to bid in 2026. Most believe it'll be, you know, it'll get multiple networks involved. You would think ESPN and Fox would share the new CFP expanded playoff broadcasting rights. And Caparelli mentioned, hey, we need to get more TV partners involved in the bowls too. You know, ESPN owns and operates, I think, 17 of them and broadcasts all but 3. So he opened the door that we need to get bowls to agree to deals with, you know, new networks.
More bowls.
So
more bowls.
More bowls and more competition. If Fox and ESPN are now bidding for all those bowls against each other,
yeah,
might be more dollars.
ESPN, yeah. Most ESPN owns the most bowls. Like they just made, like I said, they just, hey, New Mexico Bowl. We just ran a college stadium. The place is empty anyway. I mean, they're done cheap. It's done cheap. And here you are. So, yeah, I don't see the college football is an amazing sport because, like we said earlier, the panics, the complaints, the different things people are convinced are horrible almost never have any basis in reality.
Mm.
Like, it's just, you go back to those Jim Delaney quotes about the bowl industry is dead. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's literally the most powerful guy then, just scaremongering. Like, it's like, that was never going to happen.
No.
Absolutely never. There was no way. He's too smart to not know that. Like, I don't know why the leaders of this sport just crap all over the sport so much. It's just amazing. They're constantly telling you that everything's horrible. And it's like, what a weird, like, do you think Roger Goodell, literally, they could be like, scandal after scandal after scandal. He stands up there at the end at the Super Bowl press conference. Hey, you know, ratings are, it is, wow, you know, you got caught. They were cheating and there was a domestic, whatever, moving on. Like, college administrators and coaches are like, this is horrible. Everything's dying. It's like, calm down, people. It's your sport. Like, I'm the last guy that ought to be propping you guys up. Jesus, I don't even care.
It's so cooked into the DNA of college athletics, though. I mean, it's always been a conflict with itself, with a higher education. Like, should we have athletics? How important should it be? Oh, my gosh, people really like it. Holy cow, we can make a lot of money off of this. Huh, maybe we should put even more into it. And then the other side, the academic side, no, this is terrible. And that's always been the conflict. And I think it just carries over to like every issue that's ever come up. And a lot of this is still amateurism driven. There's some people that don't like the idea of players getting money, obviously, or having free transfers. Player empowerment is the big issue that's, you know, it's eternal and ongoing. And I just don't know whether it's that easy to get people to think outside of everything that's wrong in college sports and think of what's right. And I include myself in that. I've certainly complained plenty about
people think that like there's seven teams in a bowl because it's a participation trophy. It's no, there's a reason there's a Starbucks on every corner. You could sit there and say this devalues the Starbucks because there's, you can get a Starbucks everywhere, a McDonald's everywhere. And you go, yeah, the reason it's there is because Starbucks and McDonald's go, I can make money every two blocks. Yep. So I'm going to keep putting them up. And instead, it's like the concept's like, oh, they must feel bad that this little neighborhood doesn't have a Starbucks and this block doesn't have a Starbucks. And it's like, no, they're not doing it for that. None of this stuff is being done. Anyway, that's a different thing. One more NIL-related thing I thought was pretty interesting that I saw. So we have some quarterbacks hitting the transfer portal or returning for like fifth and sixth years, including Sam Hartman is, after 5 years at Wake Forest, is transferring. he will not do a sixth at Wake. People are disloyal Sam Hartman. How many years you got to be at Wake?
Yeah,
I was like, he gave 5 years. I don't know. That's pretty good.
He did his time. He did his time.
Maybe he wants to try something out. He's like, took every class at the school. Like, he's out of school. I think I'm going to try something. Might go to Notre Dame. But an interesting concept is that a guy like Sam Hartman or Devin Leary, these guys with mid to late round grades, Max Olson pointed this out from The Athletic, you can do pretty well with NIL compared to trying to make it in the NFL.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, sure. Now this worked out amazingly for our Ames Tapwater hero, Brock Purdy. But it was San Francisco because he's now, who knows, man? He's playing great. Yeah. That water still, the minerals are still floating around. See? And he's in the next Tom Brady.
It's the key to his success.
We've made that
abundantly clear.
Clearly the Ames water. So as the Mr. Irrelevant, he received a $77,000 signing bonus and rookie minimum. And obviously there's no, you know, more likely than not, he didn't even make the team. So if you're like a Sam Hartman, you're like, man, I can make a couple hundred grand maybe at Notre Dame, $100,000. I don't know. Like,
you don't have to jump. We've seen this in basketball, right? The big guys, Oscar at Kentucky and some of these other guys, like you'll do pretty well playing college hoops. So some of these guys might be sticking around because they can make six figures playing college football.
Absolutely. Yep. And if you're very unsure of your marketability at the next level, then get it where you know you can do it, and you can you become even a 1 year star at Notre Dame. It's probably going to open a few doors for you. And I don't know, you know, whether Sam Hartman's like an MBA kind of guy, you know, get your master's in business from a great business school there at Notre Dame while you're playing football, whatever. But there's a lot of reasons why this would be a really good thing for him to do.
Yeah. Pretty interesting. All right. One more before we get to the semifinals. The most fight we've seen in the last 6-8 weeks of Oklahoma State game when Coach Gundy, the mullet, the Stillwater mullet, got a little chapped at a question about possible staff changes after they lose? Like 6 of 7 going down the stretch or something?
No, they completely fell apart.
They lost 5 of 6.
And then lost the bowl game.
Play that, Sean, for us.
So staff changes are starting to happen earlier and earlier now with the portal being a thing. Do you anticipate making any changes to your staff between now and next season?
Do you think I would tell you if I was making staff changes?
No, but I have
to. Then why would you ask?
Because I have to. It's my job.
Okay, well, I might have to cut you out. I mean, don't be an ass. Really? I mean, those people's lives, man. It's people's families, right? Okay, don't mess with people's families. Let's do this the right way. You with me on this? It's not fair to people's families, man.
Right, that will conclude our press
conference. I'm not mad about the game. I just don't like ignorance.
All right. So in Mike Gundy rants, this is, you know, moderate to high. He didn't yell, I'm a man. He's not 40 anymore. I get his point. But that's a pretty reasonable question. So everybody asked this question. I get the idea of like, well, I'm not going to address that right now, but I don't know why you got to call the guy an ass. But Mike Gundy is Mike Gundy, man. If Mike Gundy handled that well, it would have been more like the dog bites, man bites dog than.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a very easy question to handle. That's something we'll discuss in the offseason. Period. You're done. You're out of it in one sentence. But Gundy's got to be Gundy. And really, the staff changes maybe should start with the head coach with the way they finished the season. Ooh. Like absolute dogs losing 6 out of 7. But that is a completely natural question to ask. And you don't know when you're going to get Mike Gundy here. You know, in the college emperor sphere of football coaches, they can disappear for about as long as they want to. After a season,
spring game,
you maybe see him in February signing day or something, or spring practice. So you got to ask the question when you get a chance to ask it. You know, for Gundy to respond that way is very on brand for him. But then I actually saw something from the reporter who asked the question, like posting something very introspective on Twitter. Like, I have to think about how to handle these situations. No, man, you did your job. You asked the questions that need to be asked. You asked it professionally. It's a Mike Gundy problem. It's not a you problem.
Right.
And there's so many people that want to apologize to college football coaches for having to ask that question or questions like it. Don't apologize for doing your job. Just do it.
Right. Wow. The only one that maybe needs to apologize is Gundy for calling a reporter an ass for asking a legitimate question. I do hate, and sometimes I'm sure it's like young reporters, but there is this tendency, especially with social media, to post like, you know, after an exchange like that goes viral or after they report news that ends up being inaccurate or something, is to like go on social and apologize for it or write a note apps thing. Guys, stop. Like, don't do that. Just stop doing it. I remember it happening a few weeks ago with the TV reporter in Mississippi. That broke the Lane Kiffin to Auburn stuff, and he wrote this long notes up like, just don't do it, just let it die, just stop. And that reporter did not need to do any kind of apologizing for
asking a legitimate question in that's yeah, just now I will say this, and maybe it's to Dan's point when he mentioned earlier, but like, I don't know what we think we're going to get with that question. Like, you're not going to get right. I mean, you're not going to get an answer of any kind.
No, I was just probably about to can the linebacker ass, coach. But, yeah. You know, I was just about to right, fire.
Right,
I mean,
right. You're not going to get a good answer.
I mean, there's a chance. I mean, one of the reasons you ask is he might say, yeah, you know, that's something we got to think about. You might get that. But you didn't even get that much. And then, yes, Gundy with this, they're people's families. Well, you're making $7 million a year at Oklahoma State, dude. This kind of comes with the territory.
It's part of the job. You're not here to make sure everybody feels good. And and Mike Gundy could give a crap. If you lost your job, he ain't going to give a hell about you, and nor should he. So, you know, it's just the way, it's, you know what, they have a lot of power, and usually the fans rally around the coach, so a reporter can get inundated by the fans, and that doesn't feel good. And all you try, you know, you're just trying to do your job. But the fans, I mean, if I'm a fan of Oklahoma State, I'm like, what are we going to do with this stat? Like, we got to do some things here.
Yeah.
Like, this is terrible.
Yeah, I would think the fans want that question asked.
What'd you think of the third down conversion in this game? You're just sitting there going, our team sucked down the stretch. What the hell happened? What are we going to do here, coach?
Right.
And so that's what you want to know. But, yeah, it does get contentious now. And this is literally just a question that's a totally reasonable question. This isn't even the Ole Miss guy getting the story completely wrong.
Right.
I mean, like that one, maybe you're like, hey, I screwed up. I need to double. I don't know what that he wrote either. But, yeah, well, good to see the mullet's got a little fight in him. It's more than he gets. This is something.
Yeah, we'll see if that carries over at all to next year.
Yeah, right.
The best thing about the Mississippi TV guy's thing explanation was like the wife of the Mississippi State president dropped a hammer on him after that on Twitter. Did she not, Ross?
I believe she kind of made she replied to it, and it was like a kind of a snarky comment. I think it was something like, and the reporter's name is John. And I think it was something like, John, baby, your work here is done. Almost like a little comment of, hey, you provided a distraction for the Bulldogs to go in there and win. Thank you. Now you can stop. You know, it was good. That was Rhonda Keenum.
There you go.
The wife of Mark Keenum, the Mississippi State president and the CFP chair, a very powerful person. And I believe Lane Kiffin himself retweeted that reply from Rhonda Kiffin. You really can't make it up, man. The sip, man, only in the sip.
All right, let's get to this this little Ohio State-Georgia game. Just a little thing going down in Atlanta. You're both there. Yep. I want to start with the Buckeyes because I think Ryan Day is the most interesting character in this drama. ESPN's doing the greatest story ever played or something. That's their marketing slogan. I like that. I don't know if you guys have spoken to Ryan. He's done some interviews already, but much fan unease in Ohio State after the second Michigan loss. They're not going to fire Ryan Day, nor should they, but there's a lot of, we're not sure this is the right guy. He lost twice to Michigan. Is that unfair? Probably, but whatever. That's how you get the job. That's how you get the money. You got to win. And it looked like it was going to be a long, long off season. They've also had some recruiting losses of late, which, you know, they'll fill in. They'll be okay. Little old Buckeyes. But here's the reprieve. And so he has two chances here, pressure and opportunity. They beat Georgia and presumably even beat Michigan. Who the hell cares what happened last month? They get run out the door by Georgia. It's even worse. And I don't know if it becomes so toxic that it doesn't make Ryan Day consider the NFL a little bit more.
Yeah.
But Ross, start with you. Your thoughts on the Ryan Day situation and the whole Buckeye program, that this feels a little bit like a referendum when these other schools are all kind of sitting pretty. I mean, I don't think anyone at TCU really, you know, there's not going to be a lot. Might be some disappointment if they lose, but there ain't going to be any anger.
No, and it's crazy to think about that the fan base is in the situation that it's in or feeling like it's disappointed in its coach when Ryan Day's record at Ohio State is 45-5. It's truly remarkable. You know, two conference titles, you know, advanced obviously to the championship game a couple years ago,
lost to Alabama. And here we sit talking about how angry the fan base is, and it's just probably gives you an idea of how important that Michigan-Ohio State game is. And, well, you know, we had interviews today, earlier this morning here in Atlanta, and, you know, I hopped around to different tables of Ohio State players and Jim Knowles, the defensive coordinator, and, you know, every other question probably was about the Michigan game. It was about a play in the Michigan game, or the Michigan game as a whole, or there was something about Michigan in almost every other question or so. So it's just kind of lingering over the team. It feels like this kind of dark cloud, and yeah, it can be kind of removed with a win Saturday, but right now it does feel like it's lingering. It does feel like it's lingering over Ryan Day, and I think Danny makes a great point. They're not going to fire Ryan Day, but if they do get blown out in this game, you do wonder if he thinks more about the professional ranks. In there'll be opportunities there, I'm sure, for him if he wants it.
Yeah, this goes back. I mean, I remember sitting there at Big Ten Media Day in July and Ryan Day saying 11-2 is a successful year in a lot of places. It wasn't for us. And that was last year. You know, we didn't beat Michigan. We didn't win the Big Ten. We didn't win the national championship. And everything all offseason was all about getting tougher to beat Michigan. And then they got plowed by Michigan. So it just exacerbated everything that they were supposedly, you know, trying to fix. And yeah, to Ross's point, I mean, the questions were endless about Michigan, especially today was their defense day. Yesterday, offense, there weren't as many, but it was absolutely endless. And players, somebody finally even asked, are you tired of hearing about the Michigan game? And they're all like, yes, we are. But that's the problem. It's the last game you played. It's the biggest game you played, and you got trucked. So you're going to hear about it. Georgia was in this same situation last year. They couldn't beat Alabama. They kept losing to Alabama in big games. They got upset in the SEC championship. They got beat by 17. And all the questions were, oh, my God, here we go again. Can you ever beat Alabama? Can you get it back together? And they did, and they handled it extremely well. I think there's more doubt about this Ohio State team than there was about Georgia last year. But it's a similar situation in terms of having a month to stew in a really bad loss.
What about Georgia? Win the national title last year. They haven't lost this year. They lost 15 players to the NFL draft a year ago, and it's sort of like the beat keeps going. What is the mood with Georgia right now, and what were they saying? I know you guys just came from that, so I don't really – you tell me what to discuss.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I feel like there's a level of confidence there. I don't know whether it's overconfidence, but I mean, there's certainly a level of confidence. Like, look, we've been here, we've done that, and we haven't lost in a long damn time. And Georgia, I believe, is absolutely the most physically dominant team in college football by a wide margin. They're what Alabama used to be. And you turn on the tape of Michigan-Ohio State and you see a team that you dominated last year physically dominate the Buckeyes. And I think you're looking at that, and I think it would be almost natural to have some level of overconfidence. Like, yeah, we're gonna push these guys off the field. Nobody is saying that. It's not overt, but I kind of get that sense that that's the underlying feeling from Georgia. And now on the other hand, the flip side, you know, and I think this is Ohio State's big hope, is Georgia's secondary got roasted by LSU. It didn't matter because they scored 50, but they gave up 500 yards. And Ohio State has the best passing game probably in the country. So if Georgia wants to find itself in an unexpected, uncomfortable shootout, it could if they don't tighten it up a little bit better on the back end this time.
Yeah, you do feel, when you talk to Georgia players and coaches too, you do feel a pretty high confidence level. And maybe that's something that Ohio State can take advantage of. Maybe that's something that's going to be a detriment in some way. I don't necessarily think so, but I think what Pat said is right. They're just like physically just, you know, wear you down, beat you down. And Jim Knowles, the Ohio State defensive coordinator, talked about that actually this morning. He was comparing, I thought it was interesting, he was comparing Michigan's offense to Georgia's offense and how similar that they are schematically, how similar they are, their use of tight ends, their use of play action, and the fact that they wear you down and they run the ball so consistently. And he was talking about how when you gang up and you want to stop the run, and so you gang up and you be aggressive, you try to match the physicality, and then boop, that's where the play action comes in and they'll hit you deep.
One other thing I want to point out. Speaking of fan media, I should say, interactions with the with these guys, somebody asked in the Ohio State media room, you know, there's another semifinal and TCU is playing another team. It's like, you're in the media, dude. You can say Michigan. The team it's okay to say the word Michigan if you're in the media. But they're all so trained to think and all about that school up north. That's the way we refer to them. It's like, oh, my God.
The weirdest was when Urban Meyer would, like, throw people out of the, if you wore blue, into his building.
Ah, yes. Les Miles used to make comments if you wore red. At his press conference, he would call you out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know. Dude, I'm not coordinating my
I don't have to dress for you.
Like an NFL scout. Like, I'm here to try to give your guys jobs. Like, deal with it. You know, whether the New York Giants, I have blue. It's a color, a primary color at that. Show up with a Michigan hat or something. All right, you're being a little
bit. Yeah, that might be pushing.
But even
like the dude that went to Gundy's house wearing an Oklahoma shirt to, like, do the floors or something. Remember back when it was like 15 years ago?
Oh, another Gundy got mad at the floor guy? Yeah.
Yeah, some guy showed up to do some work on his house wearing an Oklahoma shirt. And he threw him out.
I mean, if you hire a floor guy in Oklahoma, there's at least a 63% chance he's going to show up with some kind of Sooner gear.
Yeah.
I mean, you go anywhere in the state. Anyway, all right. The other one, well, I don't know. Should we make our picks too? We got two picks, huh?
Yeah.
Let's do it. All right. So George is given 6.5. Pat, your thoughts?
Lay the lumber. I think that's not enough points. Again, I said, you know, could this turn out into a shootout? Yes, but I don't think Ohio State has any chance to run the ball. So they're just going to have to drop back and throw 50 times. And well, C.J. Stroud's hard to sack. He's not sacked very often. They protect him well, and he's shifty in the pocket. He gets rid of the ball. He's not a great running threat, but he avoids getting sacked. So that helps. But I just think Georgia absolutely is better on both lines of scrimmage, and they've got enough playmakers that they're going to hit some plays against that Ohio State defense that is not great.
I agree. Yeah,
Georgia big.
Yeah, I agree. I think Georgia covers the 6.5. It feels like a 10-14 point game here. I think Ohio State, Georgia's, you know, two touchdowns better. Fit more physical, like Pat said, you know, on the lines, more talented. I think that Ohio State, if it's gonna win, like we've talked about, it's gotta hit it deep. It's gotta take advantage of its advantage, maybe in the skill position at receiver and obviously quarterback there. But people have been sleeping on old Stetson and in Georgia's offense. You know, I went to the ranking, the stats the other day. I think they're seventh or eighth in total offense. So this is a complete team that's better offensively than it was even last year. So I'll take the Bulldogs and to cover this.
I'm going to agree. I just think Georgia. Look, if the two favorites win, we're going to have a Georgia-Michigan discussion, and we're going to be like, Georgia does all the stuff Michigan does, just maybe a little bit better at most of it. So it's really hard to see how this matchup goes well coming off of it. Now, that said, I'm going to say this about the Buckeyes. Like, I can't even remember the last time, like, this program was discussed with such, like, lack of regard. I don't want to say disregard, but it's just sort of like, they don't really stand a chance. They're rarely underdogs. And I know it's only 6.5, but it just feels like this defeatist bit. Now, I don't know what's inside. You know, they're saying the defense is playing like crazy and the practices are vicious and all this stuff. And maybe this otherwise proud program jumps up off the canvas and does something here and surprises people. But that's my only hesitation. But this is not a team the whole year that looked like very rarely were you just like, okay, there they are. Like, Buckeyes are really good. They were always kind of messing around a little or this or that. It was never quite, something was missing. And can they find it? Man, trying to find it against Georgia in Atlanta is not really a good place to be searching around for your identity. So I'm going to take Georgia. That's the only guard I have on it. Is this is still Ohio State. They still have a lot of talented players, and this is a very prideful program that presumably is just living in hell, and they got their second chance, but I don't think that's enough. All right, the other one is obviously TCU and Michigan. That'll be at 4 o'clock earlier in the day on New Year's Eve out in Arizona. You know, I look at this game as you know, Michigan's in a different spot this year than they were a year ago. They're really happy to make the playoffs last year, and they were staring at this double gauntlet of, like, here's Georgia, then you get Alabama probably. I know a lot of Michigan fans who are just, they've already booked their flights and their hotels and everything for L.A. I know that's not the program. They're taking it seriously, but totally different mentality here. Obviously, they should be favored. This will be the best team TCU's played. It's the best defense TCU's played and all of that. And I guess the question is basically, can the Horned Frogs put together this dream against a much better defense and a much better rounded team of Michigan? They are Michigan's a 7.5-point favorite. Pat, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think TCU's up against it. And I think the one weak link there is just their defense. You know, they have a very good offense, and they're well schemed. They've got a really good quarterback, a really good running back, some good receivers. But I just think defensively they're going to have a tough time handling what Michigan brings to the table. You know, I think we saw Kansas State be able to run the ball, move the ball. And Michigan's offense is better than Kansas State. Several people have been able to move the ball against TCU. So I think physically it's going to be a tough matchup for them. Donovan Edwards has been on fire the last two games, 400 yards rushing. And if they can, if Jim Harbaugh can go in and say, look, we play our bread and butter football and you have success, TCU's got to pull some rabbits out of the hat. And I think just if this game starts unfolding that way, it could snowball to a degree. Now, TCU's defense has given up big plays. They give up, I think, over 5 yards per carry. So
25 points a game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing, like their wide receiver, Quentin Johnston, who's excellent. But I'm telling you, the freshman DB, Will Johnson, for Michigan, is really coming on. He's played really well as the season's gone on. 6'2", 194. He's big and long, like Quentin Johnston. I think he'll be able to match up well and have a good game. I'm not saying he's going to be covering him solo a bunch, but that's another factor. Michigan's just playing at a peak level right now, and that's trouble for TCU.
Yeah, TCU's defense. Yeah, really is. This doesn't seem like a great matchup. Like you said, you know, they're giving up like over 25 points a game. There was a stretch this year, like a 5-game stretch, I think, where 4 of the 5 games they gave up more than 31 points and 40 points here and there. I don't like the matchup at all, playing such a physical team in Michigan that also can hit you deep. You know, they have TCU feels like a team that probably should have more than one loss, right? I think it's 6 games. They trailed by double digits in 6 games this year in the second half, and came back to win them all. I mean, kudos there, but at some point, you know, that luck does kind of run out, and it did in their last game against Kansas State. And yeah, this just doesn't feel like too competitive of a matchup for the Horned Frogs. And Michigan just seems, again, just like Georgia, this Michigan team feels better offensively, like better than last year's team and more complete.
Yeah, I Michigan's problem is depth. I mean, like, losing Blake Corum hurts, and can Edwards be a feature back? He's better when he's, you know, the second back and catching balls and stuff like that. But you got Edwards doing that. McCarthy played a little better. against Ohio State. Maybe the bowl practices he keeps building. The receiving core had been somewhat of a disappointment this year, but there's some talent there. But, I mean, again, like, their defense is so good. Only one team, I said TCU's averaging 25 allowed a game. Only Maryland got over 25 against Michigan. And that game and the Illinois game are really the only, like, got to make plays in the fourth. I we'll know really quick if this game is over. If Michigan gets the ball and just cries out like a seven minute drive in the first half, the game is over. It'll remind me of that Alabama Notre Dame game.
Yeah.
In the BCS title game. It's like two plays in. You're like, game over.
And then you're off to find AJ McCarron.
Yeah, you got to go find another. But I mean, like, if they just dominate the offensive line like that, it's over. You know, you're not, because you, I remember that, you know, you're like, Harbaugh isn't going to be like, oh, this is working, but let's try to air it out. Like, no. It's like, okay, you can't stop us. Mm-hmm. I dare you. And if you can't, and we're going to keep hitting you and hitting you and hitting you, and we got more depth and more players and all that. So we're all picking Michigan here.
Yep, Michigan to win and cover.
Right. Yep, Wolverines.
If not, it'd be an epic upset. TCU's had an incredible season, and I think they're going to keep building. Their credibility now is so high. Sonny Dykes is just I think their recruiting's going to be great. Their transfers are going to be great. They're in a really nice spot.
Yep,
extremely.
You get all those kids that are from the Dallas-Fort Worth, they leave, and then it's like, I'm coming back.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Texas and OU moving out. I mean, everybody's kind of searching for who's going to be, you know, the Big 12 leader. People may point to Baylor or Kansas State or Oklahoma State or something like that. But I think TCU is a better position than probably any of them.
Yeah, great, great setup for them. All right, we have a People's Court before we leave.
Rise, the Honorable Judge Wetzel, Judge 40, and Judge Dellinger presiding. This is the People's Court.
A Christmas edition, sort of.
Okay.
Oh, no, another Grinch story?
No, it's not Grinch. I don't know if it's Christmas. It happened Christmas Eve.
Wait, hold on, okay, Dan. Last night, Pat and I were at the basement speakeasy bar in downtown Atlanta, Red Phone Booth. It's a great place. You should go if you're in downtown Atlanta because there's not much else to do in downtown Atlanta. And we were sitting next to a Michigan fan from Traverse City, right, where one of the Grinch stories took place. Yeah. Yes.
Did you ask him about it?
He didn't know about it. I told him about it.
Yeah.
How much could possibly be happening in Traverse City in December? I thought that would be the talk of the town. The Grinch fought the reindeer, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, all right. All right, well, this one takes place in New York City. Dean Redmond. Dean Redmond is a 22-year-old waiter in New York City. And on Christmas Eve, he was serving some customers at his job. And he notes he is, quote, terrible, unquote, at the job as a waiter. 22 people. It was a table of 22. So that's even a good waiter. That's a struggle.
Yeah, that's tough.
That's big. Yeah.
So everyone ordered. He got a little confused and he forgot to put in the order for four of the people's sandwiches. Four sandwiches were not put in. So when all the food came out, there's four people without the food. This is per the Daily Mail and per his TikTok, which he admitted this all on. Instead of taking the blame, he lied and said the waitress who was delivering the four sandwiches slipped on the stairs, fell down the stairs, and had to be taken to intensive care at the hospital.
God.
Rather than admit he forgot to put the sandwich order in, the customers were very concerned and very obviously like, don't worry about my sandwich whenever I can get it out here, right?
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, but then they kept asking her him for updates on her condition.
Going to send her flowers. She's taking a turn for the worst.
She may not make it.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, like, is she dying? What is up? So this guy forgot the sandwiches. So then they leave the bill, they write a note.
said, "Dear staff," this is from the customers. "Please do not stress. Things happen. We hope she is okay!" Exclamation point. Love, Paul and Sue. Okay, oh, the people at the of the party, and they left $500 tip to Dean.
No,
no.
Oh my God, these people are way too nice.
Now that's it. It was a 22 person table, so I don't know if this is totally, but this was enough that 500. So Dean, I don't understand this. First off. You know, whatever. He goes on his TikTok and admits it all.
Of course he does. Yes.
Quote,
like
I'm
the
going
media
to
guy
get...
that's oversharing.
Today's
yeah, well, oversharing. I mean, like what? Under the hashtags restaurant review, hashtag lies, and hashtag server problems. He says, I'm going to get such bad karma for lying to this table. But he refuses to, he's not giving the 500 back. So the people's court question is, is Dean a hero? was this a stroke of genius, or is he a criminal who basically conned these people out of 500 and four sandwiches on time because of his dishonesty? Justice 40.
Yeah, no, he's a criminal. I'm sorry. I appreciate a good hustle, but when it turns out this bad,
yeah.
you've invented somebody going to the hospital for an for an imaginary accident, and they leave a $500 tip. At some point, you gotta end the con. You gotta come out and admit it. Now he did, and he did on what is the point of that? Other than the fact that I guess he doesn't want to be a waiter anymore because he's gonna get fired, right?
Well, yeah.
Off of that.
Yeah,
I assume like every other waiter in New York, he's trying to be an actor, right? So he's clearly got some skill. Maybe he should be a screenwriter, too, and just, you know, kind of invent stuff and put his efforts into that. But no, he's out as a waiter. He's bad. You're out.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he's done. You can't lie. And then you can't keep the 500. I mean, Lord.
Yeah, donate it to charity or something.
Yeah, I was thinking he would send it to a local hospital or something. You know?
Children's wing at Sloan Kettering or something.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Tip the nurses who are working that night. Yeah, something else could have been done here, Dean. Look, I love a good hustle. Anyone in the service industry knows you got to hustle a little bit, but this is too much. Also, because he admitted this also on his TikTok, this could be brought up at trial. He talks another time about how he forgot to put in an order for onion soup. And instead of confessing to it, he got his colleague to sit crying. And he told the table she had accidentally spilled the soups all over and she was carrying them and ended up with third degree burns.
All right. This guy no longer needs to be a server. This guy needs to stop serving people at restaurants. That's the bottom line.
I mean, I admit the self-awareness to say he's terrible at it, but beyond that, yeah, get out of the job.
Where the hell's my soup? I mean, you want your onion soup? Oh, yeah. Dean, you suck. No Christmas for you. All right. We're going to be back after the semifinals. We're taping a sucker in the middle of the night on the early morning of the 1st.
Yeah.
Sobriety, we don't know. Can't promise that. We can promise we'll talk. We will talk. So we'll discuss. We'll break the whole thing down. So when you wake up on New Year's morning, no matter how cloudy your head is, you can listen to us.
There you go.
Break down the games. So it should be pretty exciting.
Also, I did real quick shout out to all of the Ohio State media that
got
screwed by Southwest Airlines and had to drive 9 hours. I heard from several of them who listened to the pod on the drive.
On the drive. Thank you.
We appreciate the listenership.
Boy, lucky they weren't in Arizona. Yeah.
Yeah,
everybody at the airport right now, not good out there. It's tough. It's rough out there. Careful of your sandwich and soup orders. We will talk to you later.